Welcome to the Nuclear Medicine, Molecular Medicine podcast, the longest running medical podcast.
My first.
Your first. Let's start, if you could tell us a little bit about, Professor Kolb, is it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit of where you are and where you work?
I work in London at the UCLH. I'm a neurologist, stroke epileptologist, who came to London 25 years ago to learn PET.
Right.
I'm still there.
Good. We just had a very interesting talk, and I think the two things that I found most interesting was that near the end of your talk, you talked about a new tracer. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
About the NMDA?
Yes.
So we have a tracer which binds to the open NMDA receptor channels,
yes,
and to the pore. And this has been the holy grail of PET tracer development. And so now we are confident that we have one who actually shows a signal increase, whereas all the other previously ones showed decreases.
Right.
Suggestive of that the tracer is trapped in the open activated NMDA receptor.
Right. So it's much easier to see hot spots than it is to see cold spots.
Yeah.
Always in imaging,
yeah,
the cold spot tracers never do very well.
Exactly.
That's the hot spot tracers that tend,
yeah,
to do quite well.
Yeah.
So that's important. How is this important? How is this hotspot tracer, how could it be used?
Absolutely. This is far more important to see in a brain where we know there is atrophy and there will be the consequences on seizures will be atrophy. So to actually see a signal increase is far more encouraging than seeing reductions. So if we argue that this tracer reflects hyperexcitable areas. So now the hypothesis is that by removing this area and predicting how well people will do following surgery and scanning them again following surgery at a time point when we decide should we take them off drugs, and is then again will we find further hotspots in the remaining tissue, will this be then predictive of their response to drug withdrawal, even if they are seizure-free at this time? So these are the secondary, or probably the primary outcomes we are looking for in this study, is this a marker of active disease?
Right. And the traditional markers used previously have been, WebTG is cold, right, on PET scans.
Mm-hmm.
SPECT is hot, but it's SPECT, so it's not very good resolution, right?
And
again, not very specific.
Well, not specific, and there you're probably missing it. You're missing it. What you see is propagation with SPECT,
right,
in the majority of cases, particularly in those frontal lobe epilepsies.
Right.
So, and it's far more in terms of the appeal it has to the clinician, an interictal NMDA scan,
yeah,
sounds far more easier to achieve than...
Ictal studies are very difficult to do, and very difficult to timing, injections,
yeah,
radiation,
so
everything else. Ictal are hard, and so obviously, and the other issue is that, you know, FTG takes a while to absorb, so it's not a particularly good ictal tracer either.
No time with them. So we wouldn't know. We've done the initial study published last 2 years ago by Carl McGinnity, was done in a rat bag of patients with frequent spikes, etc. We saw massive signal increases in this people where we suppose they have very active epilepsy, but we didn't see a good correlation with the amount of spiking, which probably would have been asking too much if you think how little the EEG tells us about the brain,
right,
in terms of...
And the EEG really tells us about the surface of the brain,
yeah,
and doesn't,
yeah,
tell you about some of the more deep-seated areas, yeah, of the brain in particular.
Yeah.
You could have, you know, so...
Lots of things happening in the hippocampus, we know.
Hippocampus, yes.
Whilst it's silent.
Right, and we've seen theories before about the importance of the hippocampus in terms of other diseases, mm-hmm, and so on. Which brings me to the second thing I was going to talk to you about. You mentioned that you'd done some studies where you'd resected tissue following surgery for epilepsy. And what did you find in that tissue?
So what we see in the tissue taken out by the surgeon is a high degree of tau.
Right.
And this in elderly people. So right. One has to say that the surgery to hatch our beds, we looked at people, at old people who had surgery after the age of 50. So we would expect to see a high, some tau there anyway, in age related.
Sure.
But what we found was that 93% of these patients had tau deposits to various degrees, compared to only 10% who had amyloid deposits.
Right, and so 10% is pretty low. But I imagine a lot of these people in their 50s, not 70s or 80s, right?
Yeah, so they were operated in their 50s and 60s. So
right.
That is
early
50s, what we would expect probably to see. So what we saw on top of that, and that's very much in line, I think, with the current thinking, is that the tau load correlated with their cognitive performance post-operatively. Not so much pre-operatively, because there are lots of factors which are clearly important for cognitive functioning, drugs, seizures, etc. But what they did, and there's a clear correlation between those who have a lot of tau and declined. So we see an accelerated decline
in
after 1 year in those who had tau in their surgical specimen, which is reflective of tau in the remaining brain.
Right. So like we see tau in, and I'll probably be interviewing other people during the course of this meeting, like we see tau as an important marker of neurodegeneration in Alzheimer's disease and it spreads throughout the brain, do you think this is some indication of just general neurodegeneration, or is it specific to epilepsy?
So we do not know. We do not know. We see specific changes, very specific to epilepsy, in terms of their distribution. But they are also, when we look at postmortem brains, they are also generally degenerative changes. So it could well be that we have a very specific epilepsy tauopathy here,
right?
Which might be, driven, caused by the seizures, by the vicious cycle of hyperexcitable networks. But we also know that people with epilepsy are at greater risk of developing Alzheimer's, and vice versa, Alzheimer's people developing at a higher frequency than age-related people and seizures, particularly at an early stage. So there's an intriguing link between the two.
Right, but if it was Alzheimer's, we'd have amyloid, wouldn't we?
We would, exactly. And so it can't. So that's, at this stage, we don't see it.
Right, so are we saying or thinking that there was a traumatic brain injury that's led to amyloid, led to tau, and the tau's then led to
so
the
what we found is that there is a correlation between the frequency or the presence of generalized tonic-clonic seizures and tau.
Right.
So we can say that
right.
not so much traumatic brain injury, but simply whether they had generalized tonic-clonic seizures or not.
Right.
Which are the more aggressive seizures, one would argue.
Okay, could we say that that is a form of traumatic brain injury?
In a way, if you have hundreds of those seizures, that could, in a day or in a month, that could be very similar to a chronic, traumatic, small brain injury.
Okay.
And that puts it into very delicate questions you're asking. Is it that seizures damage the brain? You need to have certain constellations probably, and then they do. Not in all subjects, seizures are damaging, but if you have possibly genetics, possibly pre-constitutions, possibly.
We don't know the APOE status, for example.
We wouldn't know, but that would be something to look at.
Right, and presumably we're perhaps epilepsy is a cause of chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Well or the unwell, it's causing a chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Right.
Well, it's a cause. Well, it would be. Well, or clearly in the. Well, but that is actually. So there must be more to it, because the likelihood of actually developing epilepsy after the trauma is small. 10% if you have a bullet in your hand.
Right.
2% if you have a mild to moderate.
Okay.
So it does not happen very
well. What if you have a traumatic brain injury and we show tau or not show tau? If we show tau, are we more likely to develop epilepsy or not?
That
we don't know. No one's ever tested that, presumably.
Nope. We don't have the means to do this. And the time, the problem there is, again, that would be important questions to ask to these. But there is a window. You would have to follow these people up to 20 years.
Right.
Up to 20 years following the traumatic brain injury, people are at risk of developing epilepsy.
Right.
So...
When's the peak of the window? We know
they within 2 years, I think, or the numbers know within 5 years, 50% develop it. That's the Amiga paper. So they develop, the majority develops in the first 2 years, 50% I think is at 5 years, and then they go on
okay.
up to 20 years.
So I mean, you could do a study over that length of time. We've done studies like that for Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah. But so then again, you need to have large numbers if you think about
right.
that even in your highest risk group, severe traumatic brain injury, 10%. So you need to scan huge numbers of people.
Right, in order to statistically power your study. Yeah. But it might point towards
that. But it's still better than what you have in your preclinical TBI cohort and your preclinical Alzheimer cohorts. How many would you have to scan there?
But we do routinely scan hundreds or even thousands of people in those studies.
Exactly.
And we're certainly doing that. We've done that in our ABLE group. We've scanned hundreds or thousands of people, probably hitting towards thousands. So, and that's given us really good results and pointed towards therapies for Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
Well, it's pointing in the right direction. Mm. Do you think this is a way we could point towards localizing for surgery for
No, not no? localizing, because I think theirs will be spread.
Right.
I don't think that there should be spread. But it's in guiding people for surgery.
Right.
And advising them about their risks after surgery of cognitive decline.
And that's really what we want to aim at a therapy. So we're talking about therapies for epilepsy, which are surgery or medicines. The other thing you talked about was PGP as a factor in determining whether the medicine's going to work. Old studies now, but I think important studies that were used for looking at oncology and resistance in oncology and apply to resistance in managing epilepsy as well. So.
Yeah, no, they're definitely lessons. And the beauty of the field is really the crosstalk between very much looking at similar mechanisms, looking at similar in terms of prevention in a preclinical setup, and that's what we are after. We are this fighting the same war.
Right. So, for example, you get someone comes along who's been hasn't been responding well to their epilepsy medication. We could scan them to look for a resistance to a PGP, in which case we know they're more likely to have...
But that's a problem because that's where there's a big difference between the rodent and the man.
Right.
PGP is massively important in the rodent.
Not so important in man.
So right. It explains part of it, the small signal. Right. There are many other ECRP, God knows what, drug transporters, which we haven't looked at.
Right.
And they will be upregulated if PGP falls out. So that makes it far, again, complex to a degree. Where you would not be able to change just one, turn one screw.
Right.
So one wonders in many aspects there, and that's where I think once you had your first seizure, you missed the boat. You
right.
can't turn the Titanic.
Yes.
The process is gone.
Yeah.
Okay. Too many complex mechanisms involved at this
stage. Right. And getting back to tau, one of the things we see in Alzheimer's is you see tau spread from a location to go somewhere else. The same thing could be happening in epilepsy.
Oh.
And where we see the tau might not be the focus of epilepsy. It might simply be an indicator of how it's spreading or how chronic or the disease is, or how intractable the disease is.
And we will only know in the intractable ones. We will never look at the others.
Right. Yes.
Only get, so our view is very much biased towards those where we know they have bilateral networks, really. Even though we operate and take one out, 30% we know has bilateral disease.
Right. And you looked at the networks in terms of the brain with MRI, look at those resting networks, and there was some indication that's an indicator in terms of where those parts of the brain are involved in epilepsy as well.
Yeah, so all the methodology shows into what equally for focal seizures arising in one hemisphere that they involve and engage other parts.
Yeah.
In rising in the temporal lobe, they have involvement of other structures.
Sounds like there's a lot of work to do.
Yes.
And we need more images, because you really didn't show many examples. I guess we need to be doing more studies, I guess.
Well, yes, I try to restrict to the PET MR, but it's true, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So you're suggesting we should be doing more tau imaging that we've got access to in Melbourne, perhaps, with epilepsy?
I'm happy to advise you on this one.
I'll do that. Well, thank you very much for speaking to us. I appreciate you giving up your time, and good luck with your work in London.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Robert.